very good evening to you. It is Leah on MKFM, back with the MK Mental Health Hour, where we'll be dedicating an hour each month at 7 o'clock on a Sunday evening with local organisation Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support to provide a bit of a safe space to discuss a variety of mental health topics, as well as share expert practical advice as well. So each show we'll be joined by John Manning, who is the founder of Arthur Ellis, as well as an expert in the topic we'll be discussing that evening. And this Sunday, we're going to be talking about neurodiversity. I know, I've got no idea either, but we will find out more about that later. Before we get into that, John, welcome back to the studio. It is so lovely to see you.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. I mean, there's been a pandemic in the middle.
There has been.
And a lot has happened since then. For anybody that doesn't know you and the great work that Arthur Ellis do within the local community, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support?
Yes, so I'm John. Hello. So I set up Arthur Ellis about 5-6 years ago, primarily to support access to one-to-one support for children, young people and adults across Milton Keynes, and then our aim to take over the country, essentially. So we work with businesses to provide training. I do lots of talks and things like that. And we use that money to fund and subsidise support for parents to access one-to-one support for their children and parents themselves. So now we work with about 2,000 families across Milton Keynes.
Wow.
We work with about 75% of the GP surgeries, so people can go to their doctors and get referred. So I think roughly about 200,000 people in Milton Keynes can access our services now.
Gosh, that is absolutely incredible.
Because we've had a busy pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, when we first started doing this show, I think it was it 2019 that we did the first Mental Health Hour?
Yeah,
and actually you were a totally different organisation then to what you are now, but it does just show such a need for the services that you do provide, and absolutely amazing that that many people can now access your services.
Yeah, I've got awful lot more wrinkles. Team is a lot bigger. We've got a very diverse team now, and it's got a bit weird. Like last week, I was at Buckingham Palace, like with the coronation. Yeah, getting invited all sorts of places,
look at
which
you,
is nice.
Mr. VIP.
But generally, I set arthritis. I was personally diagnosed with bipolar disorder about sort of 6 years ago. So continue listening. Some weird stuff might happen. I'm stable. It's fine. But it was really like finding that diagnosis or getting to a point where, the, you know, a doctor's telling me what's wrong. But hopefully from this show and everything that Arthur Ellis does, it kind of helps people with what's next. So I've got X, Y and Z, or I'm experiencing X, Y and Z. What do we do about it? So hopefully these shows will be actionable and helpful for people of all ages.
Absolutely. So we're going to be talking about some practical tips and help and advice for lots of people locally. We're going to be talking about neurodiversity this evening, and we're also joined in the studio by Jane Lambert. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Leah. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
A pleasure. Lovely to have you with us. So tell us a little bit about you and what it is that you do in Milton Keynes.
So many people that know me will know that I have 3 adopted children who are all neurodiverse. So I'm here through lived experience, but I'm also a qualified nurse. I run ECG Healthcare Group. So that's a company that I've been running for 21 years. In the last few years, really since the pandemic, we've also opened up a private clinic in Bradwell Abbey called Makewell. And we offer those services that are difficult for people to access. And one of the services and why I'm here today is to talk about ADHD and autism assessments and ongoing support. And that's something that we offer at Makewell.
Right. So we're going to be talking about neurodiversity. Is that kind of what ADHD and autism, is that kind of the umbrella that it comes under?
Yes, absolutely. So we often hear the terminologies neurodiverse or neurotypical. And really, it's just looking at the fact that people's brains, for whatever reason, sometimes are wired differently. So it's about people being different. And people are probably more likely to have heard terms like ADHD and autism, the different ways that people can be neurodiverse.
Right. OK, so throughout this evening, we're going to be talking about how you can identify neurodiversity, how there are different systems and setups in place within Milton Keynes and the impact that it can have on individuals and families as well. So we'll get into that right after this. So it's the Mental Health Hour with Leah, and this evening we're joined by John from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support and Jane Lambert from ECG here in Milton Keynes. Talking about neurodiversity, and actually before we started talking about neurodiversity, I actually didn't understand the link between neurodiversity and there also being mental health issues as well. But there is a link there, isn't there, John?
Yeah, massively. Often these two things are seen in the family. If it's happened to you, it's seen very much as a connected thing. So if you can imagine somebody who might have sensory issues or autism, ADHD, we'll go into more about what they are, but it can be quite distressing But generally speaking, when a practitioner is looking at somebody who has one of these neurodiverse conditions, they will look at it neurologically. So kind of as a nuts and bolts of your brain kind of thing, rather than the holistic or the other emotional aspects of it. So someone who might have autism, understandably, if they feel like they're in a place that's unfamiliar, they'll be anxious. And that'll exacerbate the condition or the way that they behave as a result. But typically, if someone's diagnosed, they'll go down a route of neurology and nuts and bolts of brain, rather than looking at the emotional aspects of it that might actually be exacerbating the condition. So these things are really interlinked. And generally, it's all summarized by a word called SEND, S-E-N-D, which is Special Educational Needs and Disabilities. So in every school, there'll be a SENDCO, which is a Special Educational Needs and Disabilities Coordinator.
Right.
So there's a bunch of people in society that are really supportive of these things, and it's really important to know, or I guess from our perspective in our service, we see lots of people who are neurodivergent, but we see them from the perspective of, look, we can't fix your autism, but we can make your experience better by teaching these strategies and those sorts of things. So from our perspective, well, we're mental health. So we don't necessarily, we haven't got neurologists or anything like that, but we can certainly support the emotional side of it. But unfortunately, sometimes they're kind of seen as very separate rather than things that coincide.
You were just saying about there being a team within schools that would pick up on those things. Would that be kind of the first port of call for people? If you were a parent, say, for example, of somebody and you started noticing maybe some different behaviours, would you be filtered through the school system?
It comes up all over the place. We've had emails or referrals from parents who their child's diagnosed themselves with ADHD off the back of a TikTok video, for example.
Right.
It could be that the school pick up on it independently, but usually people start picking up on it within the home and begin to notice that there's maybe something going on here that may lead to eventually an assessment. But school picks it up, GPs might pick it up, or other healthcare professionals, and then parents and maybe friends and family as well.
And in your experience, Jane, is that kind of how it started with you? Was it through school with your children? How did your experience work?
So, yeah, similar. And so I think with my children, it was a mixture of school, seeing certain behaviours, and certainly without doubt at home. And I think, you know, when my children were a lot younger, it's difficult to differentiate between what is unusual behaviour or something that's a little bit different to other people of the same age, but that comes out more as they seem to get older. So certainly with me, my experience, obviously I was the one pushing for an assessment. My GP was extremely supportive, as many are, and asked NHS to assess my youngest, I was talking about at the moment, but she didn't meet the criteria to have an assessment, which is very difficult when you're trying to put your child's needs and issues down black and white on paper for somebody else to sort of make that decision.
When it's so emotional as well, like it's very difficult to quantify emotional things, I find. I don't know if that process was difficult.
Absolutely. It's how do you articulate all of your concerns, and how do you articulate, 'cause even when we're talking about children with ADHD or autism, everyone presents in different ways. Mm. So no one child is the same or has the same experience. So it's hugely demoralising as a parent to know that something's different and be faced with that blank wall, really.
And for them to actually, because you can imagine a child trying to articulate complex feelings, it's so tough.
That's challenging, yeah.
Really tough. So we generally see that they've got to have a really good relationship with somebody to open up in that to that degree. So we usually see with our one-to-one service, second, third appointment, things really start coming out. So even through services, if someone's being offered an assessment, that might be a one-off rather than really spending
absolutely
a lot of time with a practitioner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the same with school. I think sometimes in primary schools where children spend more time with one teacher, some things can be picked up easier than perhaps once they reach secondary school where they move around teachers and actually nobody has a long time or a kind of a built-up relationship with that child and seeing what's different. So certainly in my experience, obviously, I couldn't get mine assessed through the NHS. So I didn't even get the opportunity to join the very long waiting list that there often are across the country. I was fortunate enough to be able to go private. And I think it was a bit of a learning curve for myself. So having a diagnosis is one thing, but that's only the start of the journey. And although I managed to get the diagnosis privately, then I guess I lost touch with the practitioner and I found it difficult to have ongoing communication with for sort of ongoing help, support, medication reviews, things like that. And actually, that's where Makewell Clinic came from, because of my own frustration of trying to find the right help and ongoing help. And actually, there isn't anything local other than waiting on the NHS for a long time, which not everybody wants to do.
But equally, everyone is doing it.
Yeah. Well, throughout the show this evening, we are going to be looking at the various ways that we can identify some of those behaviours and kind of signpost people where they can get help. So more on that right after this. So it's the Mental Health Hour for Sunday evening. Tonight, talking about neurodiversity. And we were just chatting between us, John from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support is here, and Jane Lambert from ECG, talking about some of the difficulties with assessments and the lengthy waiting times for people when they're trying to get a better understanding. Why is that, John?
Partly because everyone's trying to access the same.
Right.
And the services are so stretched. If you think about mental health awareness, over the last like 15 years or so, you've steadily not been able to move without listening to something about anxiety or depression. But everything's been, Jane and I were talking about it, everything's been quite condition led. So I can go into a school now and do an assembly and ask the kids, who's heard of anxiety and depression? Everyone's going to put their hands up. If I ask the same group, how do you deal with it effectively? Tumbleweed.
Nobody
hands
knows.
Go down. And in my opinion, mental health awareness has failed in that respect. We've told everybody about the symptoms and the signs, often very, very relatable. So if you have a look at depression as an example, tired, lethargic, maybe unmotivated, sluggish, it's like welcome to adulthood.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm, yeah.
Every That's all
day,
about tits.
Every yeah. day until I've had like two double espressos. So they're very relatable signs and symptoms. But the reality is that if an array of depression symptoms, you need to have at least five that fit into three criteria of your life. It all needs to line up in order for it to be depression. So we don't want to necessarily in this show or generally talk about signs and symptoms when it might be misconstrued or it might not necessarily be that condition for that person. We can't diagnose someone on the radio. It's not very responsible.
And there are so many different signs and symptoms depending on each condition that you might have. So if people do want to find out a little bit more information, can they do that online? Do they just Google it? Do they just Google what they're noticing with their child or within themselves? Do they go to the NHS website?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of sites they can go to. And I think the key thing here, as John was saying about conditions, is actually, is it having an impact on that child or that adult's life? If it's having a negative impact and it makes you stop and think, then most parents that we see in our clinic have done a lot of research. So some good sites are the ADHD Foundation or the National Autistic Society. And as John's saying, you know, everybody's different. There's a whole array of signs and symptoms of neurodiversity, but it's very individualized at the same time. And that's something that we would love to see more of a holistic approach to assessing people and then the support for their ongoing journey.
So it might be identified within schools, but also really important for parents to kind of pick up within their own children as well. You can often identify if there's kind of behavioural changes. How does that kind of start with your experience, Jane?
Quite subtly, really. I think when they're young, for me, I just thought, oh, that's being a naughty toddler, etc. But I think the differences that I saw in my children were difficulties with social relationships, in social settings, in communication, how they were kind of regulated in their emotions. But I think as a parent, you're in the best place to see how they are kind of day and night, and actually if there's anything that you're worried about. And absolutely, you can do some Googling and have a look at the signs and symptoms and speak to the other people that look after your children. What I would say is we get a lot of families approach us and say, I really think my child has ADHD, but their teacher doesn't think they can, so I presume I can't have an assessment. We do know that children are very good at masking their symptoms. So we always say to people, you know, don't let that put you off. You know your child better than anybody else. Mm. So if you're seeing some of the signs and symptoms, you're worried that it's having an impact on their life, then don't let the fact that the teacher or the school don't see them put you off.
So if somebody is listening right now and they are a parent and they're identifying with everything that you're saying, where do you go from that point if school aren't really recognising it, but you think, no, I know deep down, I know my child, where do we direct them to?
Absolutely. So the first point of call really would be your GP. So the GP can make a referral. Schools will always be invited to contribute to the information gathering as part of the assessment process. So we will never leave the school out of that process. But the GP can refer you to an NHS. So most places across the country that I'm aware of, ADHD is often assessed within the CAMHS department, and autism is often assessed within community paediatrics. That's actually one of the reasons, another reason why I set up MakeWell for these assessments, because actually we know that a lot of patients have both autism and ADHD. And what often can happen is that patients can be on the waiting list for one and then have to join the waiting list for the other one. So NHS is one route. Obviously, we do know majority of places across the country, you're probably going to be looking at least a year to 3 years waiting list for that, which is shocking and actually heartbreaking for children, especially because it's their education.
Absolutely.
It's their important years.
And it's not going to continue to not have an impact on their life. You've already spotted these things. So the time, the clock's kind of ticking, you know, like, what do we do in the meantime? And that's what I mean by condition-based mental health awareness. It floods everybody to the doctors, which isn't a bad thing. Absolutely go to the doctor. Don't want to encourage people not to go to the doctor. But there's about 500,000 GP appointments a day related to people's mental health across the country. So if in a business, or, you know, if you're in a school or whatever, imagine receiving 500,000 new patients or clients or whatever a day, you're just going to collapse. And that's kind of what's happening. So CAMHS, which is Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, lovely acronym.
Isn't it?
We love an acronym, CAMHS. So nationally, they reject because they don't meet the criteria, or, you know, too many people are being referred. Roughly about 75% of people don't get in.
Wow.
They don't meet the criteria, so they have to find other things. So these things are absolutely worthwhile doing and beginning to pursue, but at the same time, we want to be realistic that it's worthwhile, and that's why, you know, we're here today to begin putting things in place alongside that.
And there are things that you can do independently as with your own kind of resources and strategies, which I know we will be getting into in just a little bit. We are going to be talking about the impact of those waiting lists that we've been talking about, and we'll do that right after this. So we've just been talking about the lengthy waiting lists for assessments and things. What impact does that have on children when they're kind of on these waiting lists, John?
Yeah, well, you don't go to the doctors anticipating a cold in 6 months.
No,
do you?
No.
You kind of, you need help there and then when you go. So it can be impactful just generally with relationships in the family. If you're waiting, you're kind of in a limbo period. But ongoingly, it can have quite a big impact to a child's life. So if, for example, there's some stats around this, so I'm going to be very boring for a moment. If a child reaches the age of 14 and they're going through something, they're experiencing difficulties, maybe they're showing signs of something, if they reach the age of 14, developmentally wise, the issue may persist, or 50% likely to have an issue for the rest of their lives. If that person then gets to the age of 25, they're 75% likely to have an issue for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
So these things can
really
become quite embedded and chronic. Mm. Absolutely. So that's where it's not, I don't want to make people panic or think that they need to thrust themselves into assessments immediately, but that kind of backs up our point of doing things in the meantime. Don't wait or just rely on that assessment to happen or that appointment. There's loads of things that we can do in the meantime.
So it is really important to get the ball rolling and get on those waiting lists. But within the meantime, there are some things that you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of parents that we see, you know, it's frustrating, has a big impact on the whole family life. And as John said, actually, you know, you might be on a 2-year waiting list with the NHS. You might not be able to afford to go privately. But actually, the majority of people that we see in our clinic do get the diagnosis, they've actually come in for the assessment. The reason for that is that parents have done a lot of research before, they've lived with these behaviours for several years, it's not just something that's happened overnight. So I would really urge parents who think their child has ADHD and or autism to, yes, get on the right waiting list, but in the meantime, look at strategies that can help and can support your child, because that's actually what's going to make the difference. No, you might not be able to access, say, medication for ADHD, but everything else is still going to be very much applicable. So almost think your child does have it or autism, and then put into place some strategies, which it's not that simple or black and white, but try different things. Something will work for your child or can help and can alleviate some of the distress that they might be under. And that in itself is an ongoing journey. What might work for them for the next 6 months, you might need to change your strategy sort of 6 months later. But you can feel like you can have that impact and support your child and the whole family whilst still waiting for that more formal assessment.
So Jane, what are some strategies that people can implement to help with their day-to-day while they are on these waiting lists?
So have you got a whole day to go through those? I guess I could just talk about a couple of strategies that I've used, so lived experience of my children. Certainly one of them was with my youngest. I think it must have been her 5th birthday. I did your traditional birthday party, village hall, 20 friends, the whole class, a real proud mum. This is before I recognised that she was neurodiverse, but it became very clear it was too overwhelming. She didn't cope with it very well. It was too noisy and she just found it very difficult to kind of be part of that. So now for her birthdays, I focus on her inviting one or two friends. We do something that's maybe animal related. So we went to a cat cafe in Bedford for her birthday this year.
That sounds cool.
So for me, rather than changing my daughter to fit into society of this is how a birthday party should be, it's been very much, okay, well, how is she going to enjoy it? And how do I fit the environment and the setting for her?
That's a great way to think about it.
Absolutely. So, and the same, another example is that recently she started to refuse to wear her school shoes because they felt tight in comparison to trainers. For her, that's very much a sensory issue. She struggles with different clothing textures. So again, rather than forcing her to wear her school shoes, I approached school and said, is it okay if she wears black trainers rather than school shoes, which has been absolutely fine. So again, it's thinking outside of the box, so we don't have to make these children fit into what is expected. Another example people might relate to, I don't know, is that my youngest daughter has, again, a lot of sort of sensory issues around taste and things in her mouth. So she asks for loads of bowls of ice and she just sits there sucking on ice cubes. Wow. And she loves that. And my husband's kind of first impression was like, can you stop telling her to use all the ice? And actually now what I do is I buy bags of ice and she can have as much ice as she wants. It's not doing any harm. It's not particularly expensive, is it? But she gets great satisfaction and relief out of just sitting with a bowl of ice and just sucking on them. So I think it's about trialing different things, you know, really try and hone in on the individuality of your child.
Brilliant. So again, it does come back to kind of that communication and following your gut instincts and trial and error and
absolutely
just try everything that you can.
Absolutely.
Brilliant tips. Thank you, Jane.
And you can make it fun as well.
Absolutely.
I think assessment sometimes is kind of like, ooh, looming on you, or this is going to be a really difficult thing or whatever. But we've got to also appreciate, especially when we're talking about children, this is probably one of the first opportunities they've got to be introduced to support. And I think sometimes, especially with neurodivergent conditions, people think we have to fix them. This assessment is going to fix my kid. But ultimately, they don't need fixing. And practitioners can't fix somebody. More than likely, there's an issue that might be forever. You know, like my bipolar. I've got bipolar forever. It's incurable. So really, not to say that the diagnosis isn't important because it provides you with direction, but it might, I don't want parents to be disheartened if maybe there's not enough evidence yet to prove in the assessment that there's something going on. Sometimes it takes quite a while to build up evidence. So in the meantime, jotting down those behaviours, keeping a record of it can be really helpful. But equally, what we're aiming for here is to give that young person a good introduction to accessing support, a good perception of it, that they're willing to ask for help and help is going to be provided, because that sets them up in the future to access support for the rest of their life, which more than likely they're going to need to do.
And if people want to find some helpful strategies and tools that might be able to help them, where might they look for a little bit of inspiration to know what to do or where to start?
Well, again, some of the websites that I named earlier, ADHD Foundation and the National Autistic Society, they have some great resources, blogs, etc. And maybe some support groups, or again, looking at different private clinics can sometimes, again, put out resources on their websites, talking to other parents. And like I say, it's very individualised for your child. So what works for one child won't necessarily work for your child. But I think, as John was saying, is we need to make it fun, and we need to make, I guess, children who may be neurodiverse feel like it's not a negative. And you know, like when, if I'm thinking about my youngest, there's so many positives to her ADHD. She is so loving, caring. She's got a cracking sense of humour. And I think, you know, I don't want to be all doom and gloom on this show and kind of think that being neurodiverse is a bad thing. It's not. And we, you know, we also need to celebrate, you know, all the positives.
Yeah, could be your. We've actually got somebody in our family who has autism, and we say it's his superpower.
Exactly.
There are so many things that he excels at because because of his autism, and that's what makes him so amazing. So I suppose it's just like finding those tools and those strategies to help you kind of harness that and be able to kind of live with it a little bit more easily.
Absolutely. And seeing the strengths, you know, with whether it's autism, ADHD, and kind of trying to strengthen those as well for
Absolutely.
The child. So
brilliant. Well, there are so many kind of resources and strategies that we've just run through there. We've been speaking a lot about children. Up next, we're going to be talking about neurodiversity as an adult as well. So that's all on the way right after this. So this evening on the MK Mental Health Hour, we've been talking all about neurodiversity. And for most of the show, we've been talking about how it affects children, but it does also affect adults as well.
Absolutely, yeah, anytime, really. But generally speaking, the adult wouldn't have just started to experience things. More than likely, they've experienced it all their life, not really known any different, already developed all of their coping strategies and that sort of thing. But obviously, at the moment, they're probably in work. They might have a family. Like we've supported someone through the assessment phase within our one-to-one service, and they were in their 40s. They had kids, they had, you know, a wife. And it can be really challenging because there's more in your life that it might affect. So it's really important to start having those conversations with your family, maybe your employer. And I know that, Jane, you've actually employed people with neurodiverse conditions. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and again, it's back to that celebrating the strengths and the differences that people can bring. And I think we find a lot of adults come forward for assessments. Like you say, you don't just catch it. You don't suddenly just get it as an adult. But actually, adults have created some really good coping strategies. And I think it's probably through the awareness, people talking about it more, and also people talking about more the fact that it's, you know, it does run in families. We get a lot of parents actually come back to our clinic for assessments after their children have been through, and then they go away, they've talked about it with the professionals, and then they just suddenly start to think, could that explain why
that
I do
sounds
this
familiar, yeah.
Why I'm like that.
Provides a lot of answers.
It really, really does. And actually, for the majority of people or adults that we see, it's mixed feelings, but more than anything, it's often a relief, an answer, kind of just helps to validate maybe some difficulties they've had, maybe feeling a bit different to other people. So yeah, it's never too old to come forward for an assessment. But back to the whole coping strategies, really, what helps you, and just being aware of what might help you, trying different things, and I guess about having open conversations. So in our workplace, we're very open with every employee that comes in. They may or may not choose to disclose they're neurodivergent, but we always ask people, how do they work best? How do they learn best? Because everybody is different, neurodivergent or not. We do have a lot of people in our business who have ADHD and autism. And that's something that we almost deliberately do, actually, because they bring energy, resilience, risk-taking, they're passionate. So there's some real, real positives there to have a real kind of balanced team. And I think employers should not be afraid, should learn perhaps more about it. And I'd really like adults to feel comfortable coming forward telling their employers that they have ADHD
together.
Or autism, and therefore this is a kind of support that I need to function well.
They can work together to find out the best way that somebody works. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah, a bit like, I guess in a way, you know, every employee is looking at, you know, their strengths and actually how to get the best out of them, and therefore they're going to feel happier in the workplace.
So it's not just down to the employer to kind of have that conversation, but as the employee, if it's something that you identify within yourself and you know what best ways that you can work, to just open those channels of communication and just talk about it.
And equally, is the employee's, you know, unfortunately, as I'm an employer as well, I can't exercise for people. I would love it if we'd hit the point where we've got the technology that someone else exercises and I get the six pack.
Yeah.
But it doesn't work that way. So these strategies are very usually quite individual, and we've talked about how the symptoms can affect people in different ways and all sorts. So very, very much so the strategies are going to be very individual, providing obviously that they are positive coping strategies. There's a variety of negative ones as well. So as long as those strategies are positive, then they should be facilitated.
And actually, you know, especially talking about the workplace, some of those strategies are really quite simple.
Yeah.
So, you know, for us, it might be a member staff feel that they need to work in a room in an office by themselves because they can't deal with the noise and lots of people talking at once, or somewhere quiet to go and have their lunch. So, you know, a lot of the strategies can be really quite simple. Yeah. And it's just having that understanding of each other.
And with regards to resources as an adult, I know we've spoken about it with children. Where can adults go to find out a little bit more information, maybe on those strategies or how they can get a little bit more help?
So yeah, the same websites that we talked about before. If you have had an assessment, then you should be given, again, links to resources. But you can get funding to help support in the workplace if you need special equipment or computers and things like that. So there are lots of resources that can help support you.
And general well-being as well. Like, ultimately, people who have got neurodiverse conditions are still human.
Of course.
So yeah. the general positive things that humans can do on the Arthrellis website, we call them bananas and donuts. So there's a bunch of 5 different behaviours that make you a bunch of bananas, and then there's a variety of indulgent behaviours that make our donuts.
Love
so
that.
Generally speaking, we can talk a bit more about those. Generally speaking, that applies to everybody, just within your own way that is most positive for you.
So go and search bananas and donuts on the Arthrellis website and you'll hopefully be enlightened. Okay, well, we've covered so many really important things tonight, talking about neurodiversity on the MK Mental Health Hour. We're going to do, hopefully, a bit of a brief summary, which is on the way for you next. So it's been a very, very busy first show back for the MK Mental Health Hour this evening, talking all about neurodiversity. I'm going to go to John now to try and summarise very succinctly what we've been discussing this evening.
A big job, but a quick job.
Yes, please.
Yes. So generally speaking, the waiting list might be quite long. Everyone's flooding to their GP, which rightfully they should, but don't rely on just that assessment or assuming that each appointment is a standalone thing. This is a lifestyle adjustment. So have a look at really positive coping strategies that you can do in the meantime when you get the ball rolling on those assessments. Generally speaking, coping strategies fit within our bananas and donuts. So there are 5 bananas. Move, so that's anything you do to exercise. Focus, anything that draws your attention to the present moment. And I was really thinking about Jane, your little one with the ice cubes.
Yeah.
That's such a, how does this feel in my mouth? It feels cold. It brings you to the present moment and grounds you. Anxiety is all about future. So if you can get really good at practicing being in the present, you're going to control it an awful lot more. Discover is the 3rd one. That's about learning new things. That boosts our confidence, our self-esteem. So if there is a condition there, learn about it. Get to know it. It's going to help you work with it. Communicate is the 4th one. That's how we communicate. And it's amazing how that party didn't work out great.
Yeah.
But you adjusted it. So it's not that you're ignoring it and not communicating anymore and locking yourself away in a room, gaming or whatever. But let's have a look at a cat cafe, which I'm going to be going to later.
Yes, it's amazing. Great, I can recommend it. It is amazing.
And then your final banana is help. And that's being in a position to help others. Doing good deeds around the house, looking at chores in a different way, as long as we're not expecting anything back, kind of dilutes it if we're expecting something in return. So there's an overview of those strategies on our website. Look out for your donuts, which are those indulgent behaviours that are only going to make you unhealthy, which could be scrolling on social media, gaming all the time, not communicating and isolating yourself, drinking, all of those sorts of things that might start creeping in. So keep on top of your bananas, because if they completely drop off, you're on a downward spiral to be getting more and more unhealthy. So from parents' perspective, look after your children's bananas. From an adult's perspective, look after your own and share with your employer, school, whatever, what you need to achieve your bananas and achieve your well-being.
Brilliant job. Well done, John. And just remind us again of what your website is if people want to find out some more information.
Yeah, so socials and websites all the same. It's arthurellismhs.com.
Brilliant. And Jane, thank you so much for joining us as well. If people want to find out more about your work and everything you do, how can they do that?
They can come to our website, which is wemakewell.co.uk, or Jane Lambert is generally all over social media. You can just search me and find me.
Brilliant. Well, it's been so fascinating finding out more about neurodiversity, and we've loved having you both in the studio again and the return of the Mental Health Hour. So thank you so much for your time today.
Woo-hoo,
indeed. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next month.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.